And welcome to the Rock and Roll Survivors Podcast, dedicated to those in front of the curtain, behind the curtain, and somewhere in between. So let's get started. Well, Patty Quatro, I loved that we did the replay with your brother on the previous episode, because even though we played it before, I thought his reflections and his musical musings were so fascinating now that we are fully in the thick of the third season and The Pleasure Seekers. So I'm curious what your thoughts are as we re-listen to it.
I think we really nailed on it. You know, what it was like to grow up in Grosse Pointe. You know, on the underbelly a little bit of compared to the money families. And he was so on the inception of what he was hearing and feeling in the call to book rock, you know, and it was so new. The story still made me laugh. Oh my God, the connections are endless. Him in your pool to take his album shot. I mean, full circle. It's so funny. And he was truly a character. I mean, you can tell in that thing, and a stinker with a big mouth and loads of confidence. He helped so many starting homeboys with their bookings, getting a record contract. People don't know how much he did behind the scenes to give these bands a leg up. He was so gracious and helpful. So, you know, it's important. And last thing I'll say about him, I might say we had our phone book and our black book, and Mickey, in his own very honest book titled His Unabridged, Uncensored, and Untidy Truth of How It All Really Happened, which was full of amazing factual stories about Detroit's rock build. So, you know,
oh, I love
hearing it again.
I love hearing it again, too. And I just have to say, as you said, full circle about the picture of your brother in my pool with the cover of In Collaboration with the Gods. I didn't know that until your brother and I became friendly upon you and I doing the podcast together. And now your brother and I chat all the time on the phone. He is so funny. He is so witty. He is such a little stinker, as you said. And he does not hold back. But when he sent me the video of In Collaboration with the Gods and I saw him in my pool, I gasped. I couldn't believe it. I could not believe it. I just love this whole full circle combination, connection, all of it. So the other thing you and I said in the previous episode before we replayed your brother. Now I know we talked about the pleasure seekers van, you're on the road, you're going to start touring, but there were a couple of things that I don't want to lose touch on.
Oh, here we go.
Just because I think your listeners and I think fans of the early Detroit rock scene would want to hear. So, Patty, you said that before you really started embarking on national and international tours, you mentioned three homeboy bands that you played with, or three of your homeboys. You mentioned Alice Cooper and the Shenanigans at the Farms. You mentioned, or farm, you Ted Nugent, and you, your words, the Skinny Bitch. And Cub Coda. So
Oh my God.
I have a feeling other listeners would like to hear these insider stories. So could you elaborate before we let this opportunity go and talk about your new homeboys coming in? Start with Alice, please.
Okay. Well, Alice had this farm, I guess it was a farm out in the sticks a little bit where they rehearsed, him and his band. And we used to go out there and hang. We were all good friends. And they had a monkey, and the monkey would throw shit all around. I mean, it was unbelievable. And he had his boa, and we would jam sometimes or just practice a little. And I remember Susie once had a, shared a kiss with him. And they both looked at each other and said, "Nah, we're just meant to be friends." I mean, so that never happened. The spark was not there. But all in all, Alice was always really supportive of us with Pleasure Seekers and the Quattros. We all know him so well. He's just a dear. He's a dear.
Well, I was going to say the spark may not have been there between Susie and Alice, but the friendship and the long-lasting friendship and musical collaboration of the two of them, and as you said, his authentic love and reverence of the Quattro sisters and the Pleasure Seekers and Cradle.
Yes,
So,
yes.
am I remembering correctly that your brother, speaking of Michael Quattro, was asked by Alice and others to first manage them, and he said, absolutely not. Am I remembering that
Oh,
correctly?
you're remembering right. He laughs about it now. He says, "What was I thinking? They were so weird with what they did on stage." He said, "I said, nah, I'll book them, but that's it." He told Shep. And I mean, what a mistake. He turned them down.
Well,
Oh,
that was another thing I loved about the replay with your brother is I love that he can absolutely laugh at himself and the mistakes that he made.
yeah,
You know,
always.
I just, it's hilarious, and I love him for that. So tell us now about what this Ted Nugent and this quote
Oh,
skinny bitch close quote story is, and go back in the day. You know, Ted Nugent now has a very different persona, if you will. So tell
yes.
us about the early days of Ted Nugent and the Amboy Dukes.
Well, we recorded with a Mickey and me on Look Deeply in the Mirror, but he was hanging, this was the days Mickey had his house, and he would hang there, and Mickey booked him, and Nancy was always around, and they started hooking up and dating, and I remember there was this hellacious car chase. Oh my God. Nancy, she was hellacious in her young
And
days.
she was underage, correct,
She
at
was
this
underage and she wasn't even in the band yet. So she snuck out the window and Dad caught her as she was sneaking out. This is the middle of the night. And she jumped in his car and they take off. Dad jumps in his car, chases them all over friggin' town at a very high speed. And he never caught them. He couldn't catch them. And Nancy was scared to death what would happen when she got back home and, probably shitting her pants on what's going to happen. He grounded her for 2 weeks. And Ted finally remembers that car chase as one of, even today, as one of the best times he ever had. And he called her his skinny bitch. She was quite a looker, that's what she was to him. But they didn't get caught.
that's amazing. First of all, she was quite the looker, and we did post a picture of you and Nancy from one of your happenings at the Quattro home, but we'll put that out again because that's about the age that this skinny bitch was that this was happening, maybe a year later. But so I
Yeah.
just have some questions on that. Did they know? Of course they knew that your dad was chasing them down.
Oh God, yes. He was right with him. He was in his car and just barreling down, and Ted went faster and faster and faster, and they got away. I mean, he couldn't catch him. He gave up.
I'm assuming this is, I shouldn't assume anything. I'm assuming this is the Allard house. So was he taking
Oh
off on
yeah.
the
Yep, the Allard house. Everything happened at the Allard house.
All in the Allard house. That's fantastic. So just because I remember getting into so much trouble as a teen, I didn't quite do shenanigans like that. But what you said, she got grounded. But describe the moment where she came home, what your dad was
Oh,
saying.
I wasn't even there, but she caught hell. She caught hell. That was one time. I mean, he was pretty pissed that she, number one, snuck out in the middle of the night and with Ted. I mean, he was not a happy guy. He could be strict when he had to,
Well, he was not a happy guy because I'm going to completely quote you, Patty, that you said about Ted Nugent, there was never a G-string he didn't play.
Oh my God.
And whether that's the guitar or women.
Oh my God. His singer, John Drake, we used to laugh about it, his singer in Amboy Dukes, because he said he has deposits all over the country. He must have like 20 children. I mean, we used to laugh about it because he was such a crazy guy. But he was dating Nancy, only her at the time, but he got wilder and wilder, yeah.
I bet they made a beautiful couple in that moment in time because they were
Yeah.
both lookers at the time. All right, so tell us about the third band that you played with, Cub Coda. And I want to, well, that's himself, but tell us any other shenanigans you want to share because I can't let that go. I love that band. I think they're underrated, even though I think people love them. So tell us a little bit more.
They were a lot of fun. They were really nice guys. I know Cub had a huge crush on Susie. I remember that. And we were at a festival playing, and one of the name bands had not shown up, right? And Mickey's, oh my God, what are we going to do? So he gathered together Cub Coda, himself, me, and Susie, and we went on stage completely spontaneous as the Plastic Dipshit Band. And the audience, they didn't, they're all stoned. Nobody cared. So we jammed on a set. It was, of course, a shorter set, but we filled the slot and it was okay. People loved it and we laughed our butts off. But that's what happened at that one. It
I
was.
love that. I wish that somebody had footage of that. Of course, it's as you would say, it's in the rock ether, but it's hilarious.
Yeah.
You're rivaling the Plastic Ono band. This is the Plastic Dipshit band. I love it.
I love the name. And of course, you know who came up with that name?
Of course.
Mickey.
Of
Of
course,
course.
Mickey did.
Yeah.
That
Plastic
goes back
dipshit.
to his other names. I mean, I just love it. You know, the MC5 is the empty jive.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God.
SRC became shitty, rotten crap.
Ah,
So of
I
course.
love those names. We were the pleasure suckers. Oh, my God. He had for everybody.
I love that. Well, and also Mack Avenue, for those who know, which is off of Allard, your home. Your brother to this day refers to it, and he doesn't even blink an eye as smack. And when I asked him why, and he said, because there was a lot of drugs going on that street.
It was a main drag. I mean,
Absolutely.
busy.
Still is. Still is. And so,
Oh yeah.
Patty, as we've been talking about this hot pleasure seekers van painted black with hot pink letters of your name, and you again, you're starting to tour, you have the U-Haul because you now have a lot of equipment. You have your first roadie, Martin Priest, but then you're going to get other roadies who sometimes get imbibed and run down Mac naked, chasing a
Oh
bus.
my God.
But there were a couple of local gigs that I can't let go of. I believe two Autoramas that you and I spoke about privately. And I really want you to touch upon these because, again, this is now 1967. You're this, I'm using your words again, you know, super hot shit band on the rise. And so for the listeners, just to remind everyone, because there have been a lot of lineup changes, it's you, Susie, Arlene, the Quattro sisters. Eileen and Darlene. And
Yes.
so talk about these two Autoramas, who you played with, any stories you remember, costumes, anything. Because as you have said, these Autoramas in Detroit during the height of the Motor City and the car industry and Motown and now rock, these Autoramas are a really big deal.
They are, they are. I think the first one, I think there was only one Autorama, but we did a few gigs starting 1967. I'm sure there were a couple other clubs and stuff. And we did one called the Hot Rod Hop, and it was at the Veterans Memorial. So they must have not did it at Cobo. They had this at the Veterans Memorial, where we had the maze playing hide and seek with Mountain later years. But that's the same building on Jefferson. And it was mostly lesser known local bands. So it must have been a throw together party for after the Autorama. And that was in January, I think. Yeah, January 1967. And then my birthday, we actually played on that bill with SRC. I
Oh.
looked back, we played with them at the Hideout. That was like our home place. We loved going back there and playing. So there was SRC and Scott doing his thing up front, the Babe Magnet. And we played a gig with him at the Hideout on March 10th, my birthday. It was
I
great.
love that. I love that. I just have to tease that out a little bit because so it's your birthday, which is already amazing. It's March 10th, but this is 1967. So we're
Yeah.
talking within March, April, May. We're talking within a few months. This is the 3rd year anniversary of this teen club called The Hideout. And you and the Pleasure Seekers, your band, have been playing there since almost the beginning. It's
We have.
fantastic. And now you're playing with SRC and, as you said, Scott Richardson and the Babe magnet that he was. And, Patty, I read your, as we call it, music Bible about your family. And you had described SRC as, quote, the hot local band, close quote. Those are your words. And
Yes.
I'm curious, I mean, of course they were, and so was Scott, but I just would love to hear your thoughts of seeing them for the first time, playing with them, the response of the groupie gals to Scott, anything you want to share with us.
Well, by then, Scott and I knew each other a little bit more, and we were both band leaders. So we really bonded on that. He was the same type of leader that I was. I remember I had a crush on his drummer. He was a good-looking guy. The band was hot, and they played great. It was a fun night. That's all. I mean, there was no unusual story, but I remember it was fun to be able to play there again because you got to remember the Hideouts, they had opened more by now.
Right.
So, but there we were back at our home one. It was great. Always special to play there.
I love that. So I have a setup question because we talked in depth about the Hideout and that it was just a small room for the most part. We talked about the infamous back room. You had a little coat rack place and some sodas. So now that you are playing with more equipment and all of that, was there room as this rock music is shifting? Because it is becoming louder and it is becoming bigger. I'm just curious how the Hideout handled that.
I think we were still with our same equipment right at that moment because sponsorships came a little more in the year when we started branching out touring nationally. And the funny thing that I realized as fans write in, it cracks me up because you have no idea how many people say, "Oh, I remember Susie serving drinks," or "I remember Susie doing coat check." They remember the job she had too. It's hilarious to me because that is how we started there.
It is hilarious, and I've actually seen that as well. Susie used to serve me Cokes when I was at the
Exactly.
Hideout. I love that. Well, I want to, because again, we are now, in the Pleasure Seekers van. You're touring locally, and this, as you said in the previous episode, before your brothers, this is the moment where the Pleasure Seekers now are, your words, escalating. You now have Leo Fenn as your manager. And for a reminder, Leo Fenn is married to your sister, Arlene, at this moment in time. And your dad cherry picks him to be your manager. And as a reminder, this is the first time that Leo Fenn had ever managed anybody. This was not in his purview, per se. And yet your dad said, this is going to work. So I want to hear from you, Patty. What happens next with Leo? Because I think he is critically important at this juncture. So tell me about it. Junction.
He is so critically right here. He is responsible for shoving us forward. I mean, he had never done showbiz in his life. We were coming up to Easter break. You got to remember, Darlene and Susie were still in high school. So this was a chance for us to break out and do something bigger at the vacation time. And he actually, what a quick study he was. It blows my mind. He saw an opportunity in that Easter vacation to benefit moving us forward. He prepared himself an entire PR booklet, was done very professionally with pictures and a little bit of resume. And ahead of Easter, he took a flight to New York City on his own, and he actually produced meeting with bigwigs in New York City. I mean, who does that? Somebody that comes from nowhere in showbiz. He got his foot in the door and he met with ABC Booking, which was Joe Glazer was the president. And he only, I think I've said this, but he only handled Billie Holiday, Louis Armstrong, and then in time, while we went to New York, he signed the Pleasure Seekers and handled us personally. But so Leo came back. And he also got a booking in New York City at Trudy Hiller's. So we were all set to start moving because of him daring to do this move. And I was just, I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it.
Well, this is not to denigrate Leo Fenn's talents at all. But speaking of your brother and the mover and shaker he was, and this is now in 1967. So if your brother is already at the peak of his career by 64, 65, 66, 67, he's already well known within the biz. I can only imagine that your brother set up the interview or meetings or whatever with Leo Fenn to go to New York. Because otherwise, how would Leo Fenn have even gotten his foot in the door at that moment since he's so new? What do you think?
You know what? I mean, that's a good point to make. He may have been instrumental in meeting with Leo and they talked about it and stuff, but it still took a lot of daring and a lot of balls for Leo to say, okay, and hop on a plane and go, even with Mickey's advice. And Mickey may have made the initial call. I don't know. But I mean, Leo got the booking. You know,
That's
the
true.
club booking that was instrumental in us getting to New York. So it was probably a combo, but I'm so respectful of what Leo was able to pull off at that moment and his vision to see that that was the next step. Get him out of Michigan, get him out of Detroit, and do it. You know, my God, there we were in a hot black pleasure seeker van, ready to rock and ready to hit the road out of the Motor City and onward to the Big Apple. I mean, that tempted and excited us. And it followed our hopes for a bigger showbiz destiny at that moment in time.
Oh, I love that. And Leo Fenn was the man, the manager, the person to do this. And as you said, Mickey, your brother, may have set up the initial meeting, but Leo Fenn, all on his own, had to walk through that door at ABC, right, with Joe Glazer and make this pitch about one of the first or the first all-female rock and roll band, as you said, ready to leave the Motor City, whether to go to the, ready to go to the Big Apple. And you were ready to take on the world. You were ready, and everybody saw that. And Leo was spearheading this. How exciting!
Oh my God. We were all fully, by this time, at this moment, and it was a moment, we were all fully invested in doing the dance that beckoned us, and dance we did with this larger musical universe that was calling to us now like a siren song.
Dance to the music. has some bottom, so that the dancer just won't hide.